Well, my name is Scott Ritter. I'm a former military intelligence officer. I served in the United States Marine Corps. I've done arms control inspections, both in the former Soviet Union and in Iraq. And I participated in military operations against Iraq during Operation Desert Storm in 1990-1991. When it comes to the sinking of the Moskva, the flagship of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, my assessment is that it was struck by two Ukrainian Neptune coastal defense systems. It sustained fatal damage, and it was sunk with considerable loss of life on the part of the Russian Navy. It's in Russia's interest not to broadcast the details of this, first and foremost, because Russia needs to figure out how the Ukrainians managed to hit their flagship with two coastal defense missiles. If Russia acknowledges that this indeed happened, it confirms a Ukrainian capability. So long as Russia denies this, Ukraine can't be 100% certain that that their missiles struck the ship, although I'm pretty sure the Ukrainians and anybody who was monitoring this attack knows exactly what happened. The other thing is the morale issue. To lose the flagship is a big deal, and to have loss of life that probably amounts to several hundred sailors. Russia claims to have gotten everybody off the ship, but when one examines the photograph or the video of the ship's crew, there's only about one quarter of the sailors that one would expect to be present if everybody got off the ship. So I think Russia is suppressing the damage for security reasons and for morale reasons. And at some point in time, Russia will have to be will have to come forward with all the details. But I think that will take place after Russia achieves victory on the ground in Ukraine, not before.
Some have indicated that potentially the U.S. Navy was involved with an Orion over Romania, and potentially even using Romanian facilities to help with this attack. They've also, I've been reading some stuff from one of the presenters on Channel One Russia, which is one of the main channels in Russia, which is suggesting these things, and also that the Romanians were very cooperative, and the aircraft were used that flew out of Romania that may have actually launched these. So what convinces you that this was a Ukrainian attack and it was a ground-based attack from Ukraine, and that the U.S. Navy help wasn't involved?
Well, first of all, I do believe that the U.S. Navy and other U.S. Intelligence collection capabilities were involved. I don't think the Ukrainians could have done this without intelligence support from the United States. Ukraine had to be able to find a gap in Russian defenses. Ukraine doesn't have the intelligence collection capability to make that determination. The United States has been monitoring the Russian fleet since prior to this conflict, and the United States is fully aware of the various defensive capabilities of the Moskva and any ships that were operating in its vicinity. And I believe we're able to find a seam in these defenses, which it communicated to the Ukrainians, who were able to employ their systems to great effect. I will not accept at all any notion of the United States being involved in this attack. That's just absurd on the face of it. The United States gains absolutely nothing by doing this and risks everything. It's an act of war, one that, there's just literally no, not only legal justification, but there's no political justification. There's no way anybody can explain to me how Joe Biden, how the United States, how NATO benefits from risking World War III just to sink an old Soviet area cruiser.
There's also suggestion that there may have been nuclear weapons aboard this ship. What's the implications of that? Potentially, those nukes contaminating the sea, going to the seabed. If they're on board, that is a guided missile cruiser, which is going to be sending out cruise missiles effectively with potentially nuclear warheads on. So it's this is speculation, but what do you make of that speculation?
Nuclear weapons are taken very serious by Russia. I firmly believe, given the de-escalation procedures that have been put in place for some time, that nuclear weapons were taken off the Moskva years ago and are in storage. The Moskva is not a ship that's preparing to engage in conflict with NATO. It's a ship supporting military operations against Ukraine, and therefore the totality of its weapons package will be configured to support a conventional war. I don't believe there were any nuclear weapons on the Moskva. I believe the cruise missiles that they had on board were configured conventionally and indeed have been used conventionally. The Moskva has participated in the bombardment of targets in Ukraine. And that's not something you would do if there were nuclear weapons on board. When you have a ship that has nuclear weapons, it becomes a strategic asset, not a operational or tactical asset. So, again, I reject the notion that there were nuclear weapons on board the Moskva. There's no doctrinal or operational or tactical reason for these weapons to exist. And therefore, I don't believe there's a nuclear threat to the Black Sea that would be brought about by loose Russian nuclear weapons lying on the seafloor of the Black Sea.
We've also seen a realignment. The Russians have announced it. The Western press has announced it too, of the actual way that the battle is going in the east of Ukraine, particularly. Can you just explain what the Russians are up to there? Because they seem to have pulled out of certain areas and now concentrating their troops for a different kind of operation. Can you just take us through that transition, please, Scott?
Sure. Russia said all along that their primary objective in this one of their primary military objectives, purely military objectives, was the liberation of Donetsk and Lugansk, the two newly independent republics that constitute the Donbas region. The Ukrainians have deployed their finest fighting force. That's not me saying this. President Zelensky was just on over the weekend saying the troops that are deployed in eastern Ukraine are the finest in Ukrainian armed forces. This is 60, maybe 80,000 of these Ukrainian troops that are in eastern Ukraine right now, opposite Donetsk and Lugansk. But to destroy these, if Russia focused solely on the engagement and disruption of these units, destruction of these units in the opening phases of the campaign, Ukraine is a military of 260,000 professional troops, the second largest military in Europe. Highly trained, highly well-led, well-equipped, with upwards of 400,000 reserves and National Guard units that can be rapidly mobilized. If they've got 60,000 to 80,000 of them deployed in eastern Ukraine, that leaves, you do the math, that leaves about 180,000 to 200,000 regular troops and upwards of 400,000 reserves that could be brought to bear in response to any Russian campaign solely focused on the destruction of these forces. This would be a battle that would be disadvantaged to the Russians. So phase one of Russia's operations appeared to be shaping the battlefield to their advantage. This involved what I believe is a deception attack on an axis leading out of Belarus towards Kiev that froze considerable numbers of Ukrainian forces in place around Kiev and prompted Ukraine to divert reinforcements from Western Ukraine to Kiev instead of sending them to the east. It involved amphibious feints off the coast of Odessa that froze troops there, again, requiring reinforcement. These troops couldn't be used to be sent to Eastern Ukraine. And then it required some supporting operations in the south and out of Russia to create a land bridge connecting Crimea with mainland Russia that would allow for the operational maneuver of their troops, along a front that Russia now had total control of. This was phase one. It also included strategic air operations designed to degrade Ukrainian command and control, weapons storage, logistics, fuel, as well as to blow up, the Ukrainian military itself. Of the 24 brigades that Ukraine had at the beginning of this war, Russia has said that all 24 have been degraded to the point that they're no longer capable of carrying out coordinated large-scale combined arms operations. That means that they're fighting bravely at the battalion level, but they're not able to carry out brigade or above level maneuvering. That was phase one. Now, phase two was to disengage from the Kiev feint and redeploy those troops, further east towards Kharkiv to free up troops from the investiture of Mariupol and start pushing from the south with the goal of doing a double envelopment to trap these 60 to 80,000 Ukrainian troops in a giant cauldron reminiscent of some of the battles from the Second World War, where the Soviet army trapped Germans, most famously in Stalingrad, but there were other battles as well. And I think that's what phase two is about. Phase two is about the destruction of the bulk of Ukraine's finest fighting forces in the Donbas. And when this battle, this phase is finished, so too is the Ukrainian military, and so too is the Ukrainian government. It'll be like the Battle of France in 1940, where the French and British fought it out in the month of May, fighting the Germans. But by the end of May, early June, the Germans had broken through. There was nothing between them and Paris, and the French had no choice but to surrender. And I think you're going to be looking at a situation where the Ukrainian government has no choice but to surrender once the Battle of the Donbas is over.
Okay, $64,000 question. When will that be?
Vladimir Putin, in a speech he gave last week, made it clear that Russia is operating on a Russian timetable. That means that experts like me, we don't matter. It doesn't matter that my understanding of Russian military doctrine would suggest a very rapid advance a rapid envelopment and that this war would be over sooner rather than later. Putin said that the work of the Russian army is very literal. And what he meant by that is by the book, that they're going slowly, methodologically, and they're eliminating the Ukrainian forces piece by piece in a manner that maximizes destruction among the Ukrainians and minimizes the losses amongst the Russians. So only Putin can tell you how long this will be. The bottom line is the outcome is inevitable. It doesn't matter how long it takes. We know what the outcome is going to be, and that is the annihilation of the Ukrainian army in the Donbas. They're literally, and the interesting thing is, even the West has recognized us. Even Zelensky has recognized us. In his speech, he said, if things don't change, we're going to lose all these troops. And you look at all the talking heads on American mainstream TV. I don't know what it's like in England, but they've all changed their tune from, hey, the Ukrainians kicked butt north of Kiev, to this is about to turn into World War II style fighting where all of the advantage belongs to Russia. So even those people who have been sustaining the narrative of the brave Ukrainian resistance have to admit the reality of the map. The map doesn't lie. The map shows that Russia is ready to execute this and finish this double envelopment that will result in a significant number of Ukrainian troops being trapped, and they will either die or surrender.
A week, a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months?
Well, here it doesn't matter what the Russians do. Now we're talking about the Ukrainian army. Let's again, we have to give credit where credit is due. These guys have been fighting like tigers. They're very professional. They're very determined. And they're putting up a very resolute defense. But they're only human. And their tanks require maintenance that they're not getting. They require fuel that they no longer have. They require ammunition that they've run out of. Same thing with their armored vehicles. The same thing with their artillery. The troops are tired. They're hungry. They're thirsty. They're confused. And at some point in time, all of these factors add up to the collapse of the Ukrainian military as a viable military force. That hasn't occurred yet. The Ukrainians are continuing to put up a good fight. But I think with the sustained pressure being placed on them by the Russians the way they are, that this pressure is being increased exponentially with massive firepower and maneuver. I don't see the Ukrainian army lasting more than a couple of weeks.
Last night on the BBC on Radio 4, they had a program. It was called Where's the Line? It was supposed to be a debate. There was a British general, former number two in NATO in Europe. There was a US military representative. There was someone from Chatham House who was very pro-Ukrainian. At one point, she was almost crying in this debate, and a BBC correspondent. So it was very difficult to hear any kind of debate. It was all very much pro-Ukraine. In fact, all four speakers were pro-Ukraine. And their discussion was all about the line between NATO intervention and not. And there seems to be a bit of a blurring of this. For example, with intelligence help, satellite help, possibly electronic warfare help from NATO countries. Where do you think that line is where NATO may actually start getting seriously involved in Ukraine and therefore dragging the NATO countries into a conflict directly with Russia, Scott?
Well, fortunately for the world, we have experience in dealing with this kind of proxy conflict with Russia and with the former Soviet Union. I mean, the Vietnam War, Russia provided weapons, Russia provided advisors, Russian pilots may have flown North Vietnamese MiGs, and Russians could have been involved in the death of Americans. I know we were involved in the death of Russians, but both nations understood what each other was doing, and we avoided a full-on declaration of war. In Syria, we have both sides dancing back and forth. Russia actively jams American aircraft. That's electronic warfare. And the Americans aggressively maneuver around the Russians. And yet they've avoided direct conflict. I think right now Russia understands that NATO is providing material support. NATO is providing intelligence support. NATO may be providing limited electronic warfare support, but the line is NATO troops on the ground. And that's a line that the President of the United States and the Secretary General of NATO have both agreed will not be crossed. I mean, you can have all the panels you want of all the people who are sympathetic to Ukraine you want. Their vote doesn't count. The only vote that counts is that of the President of the United States and then the Secretary General, who represents the unified approach of 30 members of NATO. They have to decide to intervene with troops on the ground in Ukraine if that's going to happen. And they have said up front that will never happen. And it will never happen because that means a state of war will exist between NATO and Russia that now brings nuclear weapons into play. If the Moskva is still afloat and this were to happen, nuclear weapons would be put on board, put on cruise missiles, and prepared to fire, because now we're talking a different level of conflict potential. But we see that in the United States. We have politicians like Chris Coons, the senator from Delaware, who now is talking about the absolute necessity of putting American troops on the ground in Ukraine to stop Russia. But this is just political cover. This is just people blowing smoke. It has no basis in reality. It will not happen. The decision's already been made, and that decision is there will not be NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine.
As the Ukrainian army crumbles, as you just described, surely the NATO countries, the temptation will be for them to start to take over that command and control role.
Well, I already believe that NATO is exercising a significant amount of command and control. First of all, knowledge is power, and the intelligence that the Ukrainian military needs to fight this war is coming from NATO countries. I mean, this is a rather unique situation where Russia is fighting, again, the second largest military, a very well-trained, well-equipped, well-led military. And that military, Ukrainian military, is getting near perfect intelligence from NATO, which can fly in an unrestricted manner along the NATO borders with Ukraine, and they're collecting signals intelligence. They're taking photographs, and they're providing this in near real time to the Ukrainian military that can then, you know, shape the plan. We know that there's Ukrainian officers and soldiers in Poland right now receiving training. I would put a dime to a dollar that there's a NATO command and control cell operating in Poland that has Ukrainian military personnel assigned to it. And this serves as a de facto command and control center for the Ukrainian defense operations, where NATO intelligence is shared near real time. And NATO advisors are working with Ukrainians to come up with operational solutions to the problem of how to respond to the Russian, the Russian offensive taking place right now in eastern Ukraine. There's no doubt in my mind that this is happening. And so there's no difference between this happening in Poland and this happening in Ukraine, except in Poland, it's not a violation of the Russian red line. If it happens in Ukraine, then it is a violation. But there's no reason for it to be happening in Ukraine, because modern communications allows the same impact. The decisions made in Poland are transmitted to Ukrainian forces in the same way that a decision made in Kiev would be transmitted to Ukrainian forces.
What's your dog's name?
I have three dogs.
There seems to be a dog barking in the background, Scott. It's, I know it sounds a little bit of a crazy question, but can you share the name of the dogs?
Absolutely. The dog you hear most vocally is a Pomeranian, a breed known for their vocalization at inappropriate times. And his name is Breck. We love him to death. He's 12 years old and still cantankerous and full of Ben vigor. We have a tiny Chihuahua named Machismo, who oftentimes joins the Pomeranian in a bark fest. And then we have a mixed Australian Shepherd coyote named Tegan, who is generally quiet, but when she decides to get involved, you can tell by the baritone nature of her bark.
For people to get up to speed, particularly on the potential for World War III here in Europe, we all feel rather annoyed, I think most Europeans, that this seems to be a war which is being fought between Washington and Moscow, but right on our back door. We don't really necessarily want it here. Can you just recommend one or two of your books that people might like to pick up and to kind of get to grips with these sort of issues?
Well, if we're going to be talking about nuclear weapons, the best book to read is my most recent book, and it's called Scorpion King, and it's about America's suicidal embrace of nuclear weapons from FDR to Trump. And it it puts America's addiction to nuclear weapons in perspective, and it is an addiction. And the problem with an addict is you need to get that continual fix. And the other problem with having nuclear weapons is at some point in time, you have to justify the expense, which means you have to come up with, a nuclear posture that considers their use. And we are becoming dangerously close to a situation where a U.S. nuclear posture is coinciding with ground truth. I mean, at some point in time, the United States may feel that there is a need to use nuclear weapons in Europe. And, what Europe needs to understand is that means the end of all Europe. You will all die. And what Americans need to understand is we're going to die too, because there is no such thing as a limited nuclear war. Russia has made it clear. You drop one nuke, we launch all. And again, Russia doesn't bluff. That's one thing, a lesson that needs to come out of this whole disaster that is this conflict in Ukraine. For better or worse, Russia doesn't bluff.
Okay, Scott Ritter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.